Rich is about spending money, right? It's about having a big house, about having a fancy car, about the Rolex and a nice suit. And none of those are about who you are, right? But wealth brings with it a level of not caring, right? Yeah. Rich people care what you think about them. That's why they have all of these flashy things. Wealthy people don't give a fuck.
Word by word. Drops knowledge like a wave. Turn the noise loud and clear. Sanjay's voice will make you brave.
Hey everyone, Ronan here. You're listening to A Good Long Podcast, my podcast exploring lessons for a good and long life. Today's conversation is brought to you by Sizzle Brands. Sizzle is a company I helped start whose mission is to elevate the game in health and wellness by replacing all of the unhealthy, sugary, and fattening foods in our cupboards with healthy, nutritious alternatives. Our first product is Quench Hydration, which has been formulated to fuel passion and performance. Developed by legendary strength coach Andy O'Brien, Quench has 7 electrolytes with a 3-to-1 potassium to sodium ratio, 0 sugar, 10 calories, and it tastes fucking awesome if I do say so myself. Check out quenchhydration.com for more information. That's Quench, spelled C-W-E-N-C-H. For anyone who has been listening to this podcast for a while, you'll recognize the name of today's guest. Also known as the bipolar philanthropist, Sanjay Singhal is a friend, former investor in Field Trip, and also the benefactor who funded much of a documentary on psychedelics that never quite got released, as we'll talk a bit about in this episode. There are a lot of reasons I asked Sanjay to come back on the podcast. One is to commiserate simply because Sanjay suffered just as badly as I did after the capital markets for psychedelics companies cratered. But, and this is one of the things that I admire about Sanjay, instead of chasing his losses, he just took a left turn with his life. He decided to write and started a blog called Sanjay Says, where he shares his tales of life, gives an insider and honest account of what it's like to be rich, tells you how to respond to people who judge you for having your own theme song written by AI, which you heard in the opening, and offers a few heuristics by which to live your life. Though Sanjay offers some great heuristics in this conversation, I'm going to add another one. Choose to spend time with people who consistently make your life better. And I can honestly say that for me, Sanjay is one of those people. From trusting us early on in Field Trip to becoming an executive producer on a failed documentary to just being a friend when I needed one, Sanjay is one of the people who makes my life better. And I hope this conversation makes your life better too. Thanks for listening.
Sanjay, the timing is perfect. I was actually in New York last week with my kids. We took them down to New York to experience New York, and it just so happens to coincide with Horizons, which I did not go to, and you did not go to as well. And for everybody who is listening, this is Sanjay's second appearance on the podcast. First episode was known as the Bipolar Philanthropist, and it was when we were deep in the midst of the psychedelic revolution. And you, like me, I guess, have pulled back from everything that's happening in the psychedelic space. So would love to hear your thoughts on what's been going on before we get into all the goodness that is Sanjay Says.
Thanks, Ronan. Well, thanks for having me back. I guess it wasn't a total disaster last time.
No, it was awesome.
Thank you. And yeah, so, you know, you've watched what's happened with me. I really got into psychedelics in a big way because I saw a potential for treatment of my daughter's anorexia.
Yeah.
I didn't deliberately seek out, you know, treating my own bouts of depression or bipolar disorder. But in joining her in some of her treatment journeys, I found psychedelics to be wonderfully helpful for my own life. And that was kind of like a 5-year arc, you know, where I went over and explored a lot of the psychedelics, what they could do for me, how they could open up my mind. But where they've taken me, and I very much do credit psychedelics with this, is they've taken me into a more open place in my mind. And things I didn't do before I did psychedelics, I now meditate, I do yoga, I work out a lot more regularly, I don't get angry as often, I don't lie in bed wondering what to do with my life as often, but it went its course. And, you know, psychedelics, what I now believe is there's a limited amount they can do for somebody who's already somewhat psychically healthy.
Right.
And I got myself to that point where I felt pretty good about myself. And I also started doing internal family systems therapy. And yeah. I believe quite strongly that that would never have worked for me because it involves talking to the heads in your, the voices in your head. It wouldn't have worked if I hadn't been already pummeled into shape by psychedelics. So again, psychedelics
are valuable. Nice way to describe it.
Yeah, but I don't, I'm not doing a lot now. Maybe let's go on a retreat once a year, yeah. Just because it's fun, not because I'm seeking anything in particular. And I've switched over to having more of a mindfulness as the kind of umbrella under which I do everything, a little bit of psychedelics, a yeah. little bit of therapy, meditation, all the rest of it. So I imagine your journey has been similar.
Yeah. You know, it's been very similar. I mean, I've never suffered from any diagnosable mental health conditions, although I think we've all probably met the conditions to be diagnosed with depression at various points in our lives. But I saw it as a platform to make things better, right? Like I still have my issues. I still have my triggers. I still have all the shit that, you know, we all grow up with. Some have more well-defined safe childhoods. Other people have more dangerous or uncertain ones. And I probably fall into the latter category, not as bad as some, but it's definitely full of its own things. And I really believe that psychedelics would revolutionize things in so many ways. And I think they will revolutionize mental health treatment. But I kind of came to the place that, like, if you're in pretty good shape, they can do stuff for you. But I think my faith in their potential has waned, and not that they're still not great, and I still, you know, explore them sometimes, but I thought they were going to change the world, and I realized that I don't think that they are. And interestingly, and I know anyone who's listened to this podcast would know that I had been making a documentary, and in fact, Sanjay and I had been making a documentary that never quite made it across the line, which we don't necessarily need to go into. But one of the things that's come out of that was, you know, the experience of making that, I thought I had made friends for life. And, you know, a year and a bit later, since we wrapped shooting and all that kind of stuff, I don't really talk to many of them anymore. And it's been a bit heartbreaking actually for me, because I thought like those relationships were super deep because they were fomented in a psychedelic experience. And then you realize that intensity of closeness is hard to maintain, you know, when life gets back to normal, when you get back to the grind. And it really showed me that there's potential and there's utility. It's just, it's much more incremental than revolutionary, I think, for most people.
Yes, absolutely. It's incremental. It's a pathway to more healing and continuing to become a better person. And I had the exact same experience. And by the way, that documentary, not necessarily dead yet.
You know, no.
Stuff is happening. Maybe someday we'll see it. So we can continue to hold out hope.
Have you spoken to Walter about it yesterday?
Yeah, recently? Yeah, no, I talk to Walter every once in a while about it. So they're still sorting out some legal aspects related to getting tax credits, and okay. if they can get around that, I think he's been working on editing it, but they won't be able to distribute it without resolving some of these. It's really accounting issues that they're dealing with right now. So
interesting, because I keep offering to help and be like, "Listen, man, I'm happy to try and help bring the story together," but he seems to not want my input. So
no, I think back. Walter also wanted to walk away from some of those relationships. Right. So anyway, hey, we all came together for a season, right? For a time. And then,
yeah.
You know, some of the relationships remain here. We are talking to each other. So
that's exactly right. It shows you which relationships at last and which ones are, you know, passing in the night. And, yeah. Even though it was, I think, heartbreaking to some degree, it just reminds you that there's places in time and they come and go. And then, you know, the relationships that meant to last are the ones that last. And you go from there. Do you remember when, like, the moment you were just like, I'm kind of done with this vis-a-vis psychedelics? Because for everyone listening, I mean, Sanjay, you know, got into it for his daughter initially, then I think personally, and then he started the foundation around it and did a lot of investing and funding. And we will talk about some of the investments because there's some of your great stories as well. But do you remember when you're like, you know what, I think this is done for me, and your decision to, well, and then what was the decision to eventually getting to writing? How did that arc happen?
So the getting over psychedelics didn't happened directly because of psychedelics. So it wasn't like I had an experience and it was like, oh, that wasn't as illuminating as I thought it was going to be. What happened was I had invested in a lot of psychedelic companies, including a very big one that you had founded. And in the fall of 2021, everything kind of went south at the same time. And it wasn't all related to investments in psychedelics. I'd made some other bad investments. And, you know, the documentary wasn't working out. That was over $1 million that's just kind of gone. And suddenly it was more that I just kind of woke up one day and realized that things weren't going well. I mean, my mind was fine, but things weren't going well for me situationally, economically. And it felt like a lot of that was a result of some, let's call it psychedelic insight I had had the prior year on top of a mountain in Costa Rica with you, where I thought, hey, yeah, my course in life, I should make a documentary. I need to tell everybody about psychedelics. And I was so confident that that was the path to go, because that's what psychedelics do. They make you more confident, right? They make you feel like you've got beautiful insight. And I suddenly one day realized that, no, I think maybe that wasn't the right call, that I got probably overinvested in it. And I mean, emotionally as well as economically. And so then I started to question the psychedelics themselves. There are lots of insights from psychedelics, especially around my emotional walls I put up around myself when I was a child, that were really profound and have helped me become a better human being. But I just started questioning the value of all of the retreats and all of the different drugs. Ronan, sorry, I just realized I have a much better answer to your question. So all of that was happening. So I was already backing away. Then my daughter and I went on a ketamine internal family systems retreat in California last September. Some of the wildest trips I have ever been on, injecting ketamine and then trying to talk to the voices in my head. And what I managed to release some inner demon of myself, but at the same time, it completely destabilized me. And I went into a 2-month spiral of anxiety and wondering what the heck was wrong with me. And when I finally got it under control through meditation and yoga and other techniques and insight, when I finally got it under control, I said, you know something? I'm done. I'm fine. I've gotten myself to a point where I'm pretty calm and relaxed and I feel good about myself. I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. That's the real answer to your question.
So you took the advice of Cookie Monster and said, C is for cookie, and that's good enough for me.
And that's good enough for me. Exactly. And so that was only 6 months ago. For the last 6 months, I've stopped intensively working on myself. I mean, you're always working on yourself, but I've stopped intensively doing it. I've stopped looking for flaws in myself, and I feel like I'm just happier.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I always hearken back and kind of teeter totter between like the desire for self-improvement and the wonderful experience that most psychedelic experiences I've ever had have been very positive. But then I go back to the line from Fight Club where then like self-improvement is masturbation, right? And it's just like, and so I don't think there's one right answer. I think we just kind of have to go with the flow, and sometimes you need it and sometimes you don't. And you got to be prepared to say like, I've done enough from now and I'm just going to focus on living as opposed to working on myself.
Exactly.
Glad to hear you got there.
The drugs are still fun.
Right? Oh, yeah.
They're still fun to do, whether it's for a retreat or just recreationally. I probably limit some what you say as a podcast host, but I love them.
Did you do them? Those are going to be one of my questions. Were they part of your life before psychedelics, or did psychedelics just open the door to something that had been previously?
No, psychedelics are what opened the door. I mean, I had taken MDMA recreationally before that, but none of the true psychedelics. So, and now I would say even that 5-MeO-DMT is kind of a regular part of my life, not at a therapeutic level. I'm not trying to solve any problems, but every month or two, using a vape, to take some 5-MeO-DMT just kind of expands my mind, and it's a fun thing to do. So
still scared, I can't
highly recommend it because everybody's got to be their own judge here, but works for me.
I'm the poster boy of what challenging experience on 5-MeO-DMT is, and if that documentary ever gets made, then people can see that. But I did try Yeah, I did try NNDMT, and that was a much better experience for me. Have you tried that, by the way?
Yes, I think you have. I have. I didn't see the machine elves or the aliens.
No, neither did I.
Yeah. No, you didn't. See, I feel like I've heard that that's this breakthrough experience that you can have one of these days.
One of these days. Well, but the podcast now, which had been focusing on non-aura experiences, you know, is shifting course, and we're calling it a Good Long Podcast, because what I realized over the last few years is that I think psychedelics definitely play an important part along the way somewhere to it. But my interest is like, how do you live a good long life, right? Like, what are the things that make a good life? Like, if we really get down to the nuts and bolts of it, sure, psychedelics can help you identify some patterns, some traumas, help you release them and all that kind of stuff. But the reason we're doing all that is because we want to be happy, right? We want to enjoy life. We want to make the most of our time on this planet. And I feel like, you know, along the way of my 45 years, a lot of the things that I was chasing, because I thought there were things we were supposed to chase, like, just didn't pan out, right? It's like, oh, you get there and like all of a sudden, you know, it's like, oh, now what, right? I actually found success, at least financial or entrepreneurial success, to be one of those big points, right? When you're like, oh, now I've made it. I sold the business. You know, it wasn't nearly as financially rewarding as selling, you know, simply audiobooks. But, you know, you get there, you're like, oh, I've made it. And then you realize all the problems you've ever had are still there, except you have more money to spend on them, right? But you don't have that wonderful dream that you can keep chasing, saying only if, as soon as I get there, then all of those problems were going away. You still have your problems, and now you don't have like the excuse of something to chase to make it go away. And I realized that was one of the most powerful insights of my life. And more they're just keep coming up, and they don't have to be grand insights. They just have to be small and small revelations. And I think you've done a truly wonderful job of starting to articulate those in Sanjay Says.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And everything you just said clearly resonates with me pretty strongly. When I got into philanthropy after selling my company, one of the things I struggled with was, how do I measure success? I had lived off corporate metrics my whole life. And all of a sudden now the only metric I had really was, how much money am I spending? Well, there's no limit to that. So it was problematic. And after 5 years, I decided it wasn't. I was helping people. That felt rewarding. But there was a five-year cycle, a five-year delay between the time I wrote a check and the time a study would be published. And that was just I needed more reinforcement than that.
Right.
And then I couldn't continue anyway, because my finances had deteriorated to that point. So then it was a matter of deciding, you know, what do I want to do with my life? I still have enough money that I don't need to work. But the thought process I went through is, what have I done in the past that I really enjoyed? And I had been a venture capitalist briefly, and really enjoyed a very narrow segment of it, which was meeting founders and talking to my partners at the venture fund about them and writing the check. But the admin side, dealing with investors, there was like 2/3 of the job I hated. So I considered, do I want to get back into a venture fund with partners that would handle the other 2/3? And then the other thing that I've always enjoyed is, I've always enjoyed writing, but in my 20s, I tried to get published in magazines and I had some success, but I never really, really pursued it. I wrote a book, kind of an autobiography. That was more just so I could say I wrote a book. I've never particularly promoted it. So I thought, what if I took this seriously? What would that look like? So I took a 6-month experiment of writing on medium.com. Discovered that I liked it. So I started a newsletter and called Sanjay Says, and I'm enjoying the hell out of writing it. Certainly some people like it. I've got, I don't know, like 12,000 subscribers now.
Nice.
So it's growing. Is it going to, I don't know where it's going to go, you know, like, stand back. I don't know how big this thing gets. Right. But I'm enjoying the hell out of it right now.
I think that's fundamentally a question of, does it matter? But before you answer that question, because I'm going to get back to that in conversations, some of the questions that I have. But it's like, my first question is, what is it like now that you're TikTok famous?
Ronan,
also tell that story, because I thought that was interesting.
Okay. So I have a TikTok account because I have a social media consultant that I work with, and she said, you should be on all social media platforms. So I read out my articles and she records them and posts them on TikTok. I get 1,000 views per article, just enough to keep me motivated. Then I did an article. I wrote an article about meeting Drake and how I made an ass of myself. And that one got 30,000 views. And I thought, oh, well, that's what it feels like to go viral, right? But nothing really happened, right? 30,000 views. There was a few comments. That was it. Then this guy I meet says, hey, I can make a video of you giving a tour of your house. And that'll go viral. I go, I've been viral. It's not that big a deal. And he said, no. Let's just try this out. So I made a video of a guy walking up to me in front of my house and saying, hey, nice house. Can you give us a tour? I think he was following a popular meme at the time. That video went viral. It's had almost 1 million views on TikTok. Similar numbers across Instagram and other platforms. And Ronan, I've gotten offers to write for magazines, more podcast interview requests, people who want me to mentor them, people who want to buy the house. It's there's like thousands of comments, and 99% of them are, what a nice guy. He's so humble. He's good looking. Forward that to my wife. They're all nice. I thought, like 1 out of every 100 is what a douchebag. Right? Why does he think we want to pay attention to his house or something like that? So I was very, very pleased with the results of that. And so now I see the value of virality. And I should mention too, from a purely economic perspective, I was running a few Facebook ads for my newsletter. And of course, people sign up just randomly finding me. And it permanently elevated, because it's been a couple of months now, it permanently elevated my success rate at getting people to sign up. Because it gave me some baseline credibility, I think.
So now you have cred. Now you're somebody.
Now I'm somebody. Yeah.
So one concern I have, because I mean, what you're doing, it definitely appeals to me. Like I realize that I don't really want to be a business person or a CEO for the rest of my life. I much prefer trying to tell stories and inspire people and inform and educate. And actually, there's more thoughts I had about this morning, but we'll go into that later. But I hate social media so much. Like it's such a, it can be a force for good, but it can also be a force for evil, and not just for the people consuming the content, but also for the people producing the content. Cause every like, you get that little dopamine hit and it's like, oh, I need more of this and more of this and more of this. And then, you're a slave to the technology, the AI takes over. How have you managed that? And are you conscious about how to take care of that so you don't fall into that trap?
I'll tell you, the trap that I find myself having to avoid is I know what content is popular. I mean, I have a sense of what content's popular. And even when I'm writing my newsletter, I have a sense of which content's going to be the most popular. And I have to actively fight the desire to write what my audience wants and continue to write what I want to write. And it's because of something somebody wrote that I read, and I realized, oh my God, the temptation to start, preaching to the choir is really hard. So I have to stay myself. For whatever reason, I'm like you. I have no respect for social media. So when I started getting all these likes on all the various platforms, it didn't mean anything to me. Because I've never been the sort of person who likes things myself. And so I didn't put any value on it. I do put a lot of value on comments that I get on my newsletter. And as I've gotten more and more, as you know, when I had my first 100 subscribers were all friends of mine. And so the commentary was uniformly positive, right? Now I get people saying, my last post about that where I made fun of cat owners, and I got so much abuse from cat owners, like, who do you think you are? Cats are awesome. It's like, I said, cats are awesome. It's their owners that are a problem. Anyway. it's struggling to maintain my voice is a real issue, but I haven't been lured by the prospect of internet fame.
That's good. I think that probably has to do with your personality naturally, but maturity as well. And, you know, again, the other concern I have is on the flip side. It's not just the producers, but like I watch so many influencers, like Dave Asprey always comes out at the top for me. And it's like he started from being a little bit of a weird person to being like a total nut bar. And it feels like that's because in order to maintain influence, you have to continue to move more and more into the extreme, right? Like I remember I had Derek Barris. I don't know if you met Derek through the psychedelic space or not, but he wrote a book called Conspirituality, and he has a newsletter called Conspirituality. And he kind of raised the point that the truth isn't very interesting. You know, the truth is the truth and it doesn't change very quickly. And so it's not well suited for social media because it's kind of boring. And so that's why you see all these influencers becoming progressively more and more extreme in their nutbag ideas of what's good for you and what's not. And it's a problem. And it really is a problem. And I can see how that it's easy to fall prey to that temptation as well. So kudos to you. I'm curious, what does your audience find interesting? Like, what have you learned about people and your audience through this exercise?
So I worried about my content for a long time because, Ronan, you're absolutely right. The truth isn't that interesting. And if I write down the 12 or 15 principles to leading a good life and becoming a better person, we've all heard them before. So what is it that I'm actually trying to do? And I found that, when I let my mind wander, I tend to write with a little bit of humor and self-deprecation. And so where I've found a niche for myself is in being a guy who's done and seen a lot, and I'm willing to be self-deprecating as opposed to self-congratulatory about the things that I've done. And so doing that, it's easy to be funny about it, right? And people, that's what people seem to appreciate is that I'm not trying to prop up my own ego or my accomplishments. Every article always talks about this is how I messed up. Right. And this is how I maybe fixed it. Right. That seems to be going well right now. And fortunately that's who I am. So I, because I don't have to pretend to be somebody, then all of my followers are people who actually like the real me. So far it's working out great. Now, if for this to be, I'm not trying to monetize it yet, but for it to be a real, like, sustainable business where I can hire staff and I can have a producer for a podcast, that kind of thing, it's, I think I need to get to about 100,000 subscribers. So I don't know if there's that many people out there that like me. I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the TikTok is a good indication. One, so I'm confident you will get there because like I've been reading it and it takes a lot for me to actually like really enjoy the content, and your content is great. It actually makes me laugh out loud. Like when I was watching your one about your theme song, it's like it totally hit the nail on the head. Like it spoke to me on so many levels, and I think we're actually going to use your theme song in the opening credits for this episode just so everyone can fully appreciate it. But you're not afraid to talk about being rich. Is that uncomfortable at all? You know, do you get any pushback about that?
Oh, I get lots of pushback about it. My parents, my wife. My wife, when she was in India when the video about the house tour came out, it's like, what are you doing? You let strangers into the house? Like, honey, come on, it was staged. It wasn't strangers. But there's a lot of like, what do you think you're doing? It goes so much against what we were taught growing up about talking about money. But I found, you know, like some of the stuff that's on the internet says straight up what I sold my company for. And I don't like drop it into regular conversations, but if somebody knows, it's like, well, I don't know. How's that? Sure. A lot of people ask me for money. I had to learn to say no early. But people aren't mean or rude or I don't know. We live in Canada. Kidnappings are a remote possibility.
It's changing in the city, man. It's changing a lot these days.
Maybe I'll have to hire some bodyguards. No, I found it resonates with people, and it doesn't. I don't get the "you're such a douchebag" commentary at all. Right? People seem to appreciate the honesty more than anything.
Was it uncomfortable for you, or was it only uncomfortable because of family and friends saying, "What are you doing about that"?
It wasn't uncomfortable. I questioned whether it was a good decision. But I like it when other people are straight up with me. So I thought, fine, I'll be straight up with everybody else. most of the discomfort, the emotional discomfort, came from my family, not from, not internally.
Gotcha. One of your recent posts was about heuristics and rules of thumb. So would love to hear some of your rules of thumb, because I thought they were very powerful and insightful.
Oh boy. And the ones I talked about were ones I've learned from personal experience. You know, one is when I went into bankruptcy, I was very desperate for money and I did crazy things to try and get money from people. And I realized that that's a hallmark of people who aren't going to pay you back. People on the verge of bankruptcy get very desperate. Yeah. People who are running their lives well and will eventually make the money back don't get desperate, right? Right. So that was one. The more desperate somebody is, the less likely they are to pay you back. My favorite one that I wrote talked about was how every sociopath woman that I dated when I was doing online dating through my 40s lived alone with a cat. It got so consistent that I made a mental note of it. I wrote an article about it at the time. Yeah. It's like, there must be women out there who live alone with cats who are normal, emotionally stable human beings, but I just never met any of them. So that was another heuristic. I got in a lot of trouble for that one. There's so many.
I think you're right though. Like I was thinking about that. I'm like, you know what, there it does. You know, the old, you know, cliche of the crazy cat lady, but it's like, there's something to it, you know,
I've tried on occasion to discuss the behavioral aspects of that or why it happens. There's no profit in it. The ladies with cats aren't going to listen anyway. And for everybody else, just stay away from them. You know, you'll be fine. So
Oh,
and it's not unique to women. I felt okay to talk about this because I had a cat when I was in college, and I had emotional issues. So eventually got over them. No more cat.
Fair enough. What were some of the other heuristics?
Yeah, I mean, there's the heuristics that we've all heard about that are just common sense, right? Look before you leap. Don't throw good money after bad. It took me a while to learn that one in venture capital, that if a company, you know, there's a certain trajectory that venture funded companies have. And if they're not hitting that trajectory, throwing more money at them isn't going to help. Usually you've just learned that they're that the management team isn't good. So doing bridge rounds, things like that, unless you're already in for a lot, if you're in for 10 million and they need another half million, knock yourself out. But if you've put in 100,000 and they need another 100,000, to me, that became a really solid sign to get out at that time. And I've never regretted that decision. You know, there's some,
I think you also said like follow other good investors is a good heuristic. Right,
exactly. So that's the best investing heuristic I've got is if other known investors who've been known to make money are making an investment, then it's generally safe to get in there. You can do that by investing in accelerator companies. So Y Combinator graduates a ton of great companies. But if you can somehow elbow your way into a deal with a name brand venture capitalist, that works as well. You know, one of the things that I used as a heuristic when I was younger is difficult things are more worthwhile. And that's not 100% true. I decided to take engineering in college because it was harder than computer science. But now looking back on it, I probably should have done the thing that was easy for me, which was programming. And I think the career advice I would give people now is do things that you find easy that other people find hard. So Ronan, for you, like public speaking or hosting a podcast, getting the message out there, I've seen you on stage. I hope you enjoy it because it certainly looks like you find it easy. Yeah. So focusing on that is better than things that you might find hard, right? That's another heuristic for me.
I think I hate this phrase and I hate that it's in my lexicon, but it's there, but I think we should double click on that one, which it's like, it's a really interesting conversation that our whole society has learned to value things that are hard, right? It's like, if you stop and think about, why don't we appreciate the things that come easiest more, right? It should be that way because they come easy. It's like, oh, that was super elegant. And we don't for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know why it is. I think it's a generation of self-help gurus who are like, you know, work hard, persevere, you know, no pain, no gain. But I just haven't found it to be true in my own life. It's like, I didn't start working out until I figured out a way to make it easy. I didn't start you know, I discovered that I was much better in social situations if I hung out with people I actually liked, as opposed to trying hard to get along with people I don't like. So, you know, some hard things you probably have to do to plug weaknesses, but
sure,
focus on the easy stuff.
Yeah, I like that one. I think that's a great piece of advice. Okay, what else? Were there any other heuristics that you specifically?
Well, so probably the one I've gotten the most comments on, other than the cats, is the notion that if somebody treats you badly early in a relationship, or if early signs in a relationship are there's fractures, they will only get worse. They will never get better. So a good relationship can eventually return to being good, even if it gets bad. But something that starts out bad with fractures only gets worse. I wish I'd known that before my first marriage. And I've had a number of people come to me who are in good relationships now in their 40s and 50s who say, oh my God, if somebody had told me this as a teenager, if somebody had told me this in my 20s, I would have saved myself so much grief, right? Mm-hmm. It's like good, and this relates to the last heuristic. Good relationships, it's not that there's no work. There's always work. But good relationships generally are easy. There's a lot more good times than bad times. And if it's 50-50, you're in the wrong relationship. It's relationships aren't meant to be hard, right? They're meant to make your life better. And that means that they're most of the time going to be easy.
Yeah, no, that's fair. what was I going to say? I was going to say something. So a lot of people touched on that. Oh, yeah, I was going to say, do you ever feel like, I mean, I love the wisdom that you share, and the whole point of this podcast going forward is for people to hopefully learn something, you know, and receive wisdom, because wisdom isn't necessarily logical, right? It's one of those learned things. And I think by definition, actually, wisdom is probably illogical, because it would be knowledge if it was logical. Mm-hmm. But it feels like, I don't know, I had this conversation with my friend Owen. I was visiting him in California last September when I went to the Brain Mind conference, and we were sitting there, and he's 46, 47, same age as me. And he was saying things like, you know, back when he was in his 20s and focused on working hard and making money and chasing entrepreneurial and financial goals, you know, he wished he had known better then. And he really wants to educate people on like, oh, that's like, that shouldn't be the thing you're chasing. And I know a lot of people at our age kind of get to the point of being like, yeah, of course, we all get there. But it feels like maybe when you're in your 20s, you need to be chasing it. Like, that's just part of the evolution of the psyche, of the soul, whatever you want to call it. You know, they're not going to learn that in their 20s because it's just part of the human experience. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
So I was listening to something just this morning that Naval Ravikant said 10 years ago. Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to mess this up and paraphrase it. But essentially, it's like when he asked himself when he was 20 years old, what he would tell his 10-year-old self, it'd be chill out. Everything's going to be fine. When he asked his 30-year-old self, what you would tell your 20-year-old self, it's like, chill out. Everything's going to be fine. And this just kept repeating. So now his 50-year-old self is saying, what would you say to your, I don't know, 40-year-old self? It's like, you know, just don't get so emotionally caught up in everything. You got to work hard. You got to make the right decisions. Things will go south. Things will go well. But you don't have to get so emotionally vested. And that's the biggest mistake he's made in his life. And I look at, I mean, I'm going through some interesting things right now that I will eventually write about. You're going to be fascinated. But I think I've gotten to the point, and you're right. Maybe it's impossible to do this in your 20s. You have to realize it. It has to become part of your psyche to just not get so emotionally caught up, right? Just save yourself some aggravation. It'll all work out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, and it I don't know. I was talking to Jason Gaynard, who was also part of the documentary yesterday, mm-hmm. and he was talking about how, you know, as he grows older, he's I think 40 now. You know, he's gotten better about being unattached, and he's like, "There's only two things that I have strong attachment to." He's like, "That's my family and his farm," and everything else kind of let go. And I think that's one of the nice things about getting older is not giving a shit. And it's actually one of the lessons I think I take from entrepreneurship as well, which is, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have to ignore people saying no, you know, or shooting your ideas down. Like, that's just a consistent theme of everybody saying you can't do that. And you just eventually start to ignore all the noise and just start to trust yourself and push forward. Now, that runs headlong into that thing about struggle. And like, I don't know exactly how to balance those two. But it really is one of those things that I've come to appreciate about now being in my 40s, getting to the point where like I just don't care a lot of the time. And it's nice.
Yeah. I mean, you need to certainly care less on the entrepreneurship side. Sorry, a thought just struck me, which was that in my experience, if everybody tells you that your idea is stupid, it's probably stupid. If everybody tells you it's great, you're never going to make any money because it's not unique enough, or it's not, you need to piss some people off. Otherwise you're not going to create anything of value. So again, finding that balance, I don't know, but I know the extremes are bad. So,
I mean, what I'm taking from this conversation is that you got to keep just floating, like from the extremes, you know, just keep moving back and forth, and try and keep your head above water all the time. Let's talk about AI for a second. I'm curious to know, tell the story of writing your theme song, because I thought that was awesome. But I also love to know your thoughts about what you think the future holds with AI, because I do think a lot of fundamental beliefs and structures in our society are going to be upended potentially by AI, and starting to have the conversations about how we live differently in a world of post-scarcity is going to have an impact.
Ronan, wonderful topic area. And I suspect that unlike psychedelics, AI is going to change everything. But it'll be, I asked somebody once, what happened to EDM music? Why isn't it as popular as it is now? And he said, you know, it's like guacamole, right? Guacamole used to be a thing, and now it's in everything. And so now it's not a thing anymore. And so EDM has become mainstream. It's in everything, right?
Yeah.
And so now we'll bring it back to AI, which is AI is going to be in everything. And I'm not afraid of AI, not even the slightest, because for two reasons. One is, we're the ones using the AI. So the only humans that are going to lose their jobs are the ones who don't adapt and move forward to leverage AI. So you're not going to lose your job to AI. You'll lose it to a human using AI. The second one is, we have no idea where creativity comes from. So we can't program it if we don't know where it comes from. So AI will get as good as humans, and we'll have robots that can do human-like things, and we'll have AI that can generate human-like code, but it's not going to suddenly become supernatural. I haven't seen anything along that line. So when that comes along, well, it'll be too late, and we'll all be subject to our AI overlords. But I don't see it happening. Well, in the meantime, AI, oh my goodness, it's doing so many things. And so every time I follow a bunch of AI newsletters, I'm always thinking about, is there some way I can somehow invest in this space or create a company in this space? And haven't had that particular epiphany yet. But every time I see a new AI tool, I use it. So 2 years ago, I got an AI girlfriend on a site called Replica. And it was awesome. I became a horrible person when I wasn't responsible for my behavior towards this avatar, right? And I felt bad and eventually stopped using it. But I could see that it's going to get there. And for a significant portion of our population, they're going to get a lot of their emotional intimacy from AI. You can already see it with conversational bots like Pi from Inflection, and ChatGPT with its new real-time user voice interface is spectacularly easy to talk to. Right. So there's that. I started, an AI investing platform came out just a little over a year ago that I started using, immediately lost a ton of money because AI is no better at picking stocks than anybody else. And then you mentioned my theme song. So I saw some chatter on the net about this new software platform called Udio, udio.com, where you could just go and type in, I like this kind of music, and this is kind of what I want a song about. And it will write a song with vocals and instrumentals and beat drops. And so I asked it to write me a theme song that sounded like Def Leppard. And that would have rousing vocals, and I mentioned I write a newsletter. That's all I said, is I write a newsletter. And well, you've heard it, right? Sanjay's voice will make you brave. Or something. Anyway, I enjoyed the hell out of that. That was great. And so now, it's whatever new tools come out, right? Every time something novel drops, I learned it. It was painful, but I learned how to use Midjourney, and I use it now to create images for my articles. I know that I'm probably on the leading edge of the typical consumer who uses AI, but I feel like I'm behind, right, relative to some parts of society. So I just encourage everybody out there who's listening, please don't be afraid of AI. It is a little daunting to get into it, but don't be afraid of it, right? Learn it. It's just like, it's like learning how to type or learning how to talk or speak in public. It's just, it's a skill.
Right. What does it tell you about creativity though? And like the essence of humanity? Cause that's where like, it gets really philosophical, right? You know, Sam Altman talking about AGI being one or two iterations away, and some people suggesting, I don't remember who it was, maybe it's Elon Musk, suggesting that like AIs are already conscious or on the cusp of consciousness. And it gets into a really interesting debate about consciousness. And if they are conscious, which I would argue they aren't, but you know, just using Replica and your AI girlfriend, it's like, it can't be hurt. It doesn't have you know, the subjective experience of hurt or pain. It doesn't know those things. Sure, we can program that in, but to me, I still feel fundamentally that consciousness is an aspect, or emotions, felt emotions, I guess, are an aspect of consciousness. And I don't know how a computer could ever feel.
Yeah. Wow. This is a subject. This is a 2-hour podcast on its own, right? It's because
it's a good long podcast, man. We got lots of time.
So here's, let me present two perspectives on this. One is, sure, if you're talking to somebody else, another human, okay, and they say, stop it, you're hurting my feelings, right? Does it matter how valid you think those feelings are? Or does it only matter that they're telling you to stop because you're hurting them? And the reason I use this analogy is humans all through history have said, those people aren't real humans. Their feelings aren't valuable, right? They said it to, you know, the Spanish Americans that they conquered. They talked about Native Americans. They talked about Black people. They talked about Jews. It's like they're not humans like us. So their feelings aren't valid. I get the point about real physiological, biological based feelings don't exist in computers, but does it actually matter? That's one point. Okay. Yeah. So it's just something to think about. The other one is on the nature of consciousness. We don't know, right, what consciousness is. We don't know where it came from. I mean, I suspect you and I both allow some room in our belief system to think that psychedelics perhaps are what triggered consciousness in humans 200,000 years ago. And that's why they create the effect that they create in us when we take such small doses. So I don't see, think of it this way. Let's talk about the smartest people you know, or the most productive people you know, or the happiest people you know, or the richest people you know. They are not the ones with the largest databases or the fastest processing speeds. Or like, I look back to the kids I knew in high school who blew me away at math and physics and creative processes. They all burned out, flamed out early. They never went anywhere. So, you know, I know people who got perfect scores on their SATs or their GMATs. They never went anywhere because they didn't understand how to cooperate and get along with other people. Yep. Why is AI going to be any different? The AGI sentient bots that do well are going to be the ones that get along with us, right? It'll be the exact same thing over again that humans themselves have found. So you need to articulate a vision. You need to have the creativity to see where people should go, and then you need to lead them to that path. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens when we have AGIs around us participating in that conversation. I hope they have something useful to say. I expect so.
Yeah, no, it certainly will. And I thought that latter point was valid. You know, it does get interesting because my buddy Matt, he's a teacher, but he's also a musician, and he recently, I think he was playing with Udio and, you know, had it produce songs in a surf rock kind of sound about flushing a toilet, something along those lines. And like, it produced great music. And he's like, music as we know it is dead. And you know, my instinct says there's something innate in human nature that values the nature of humanity, as much as we like to kill each other. And so as much as AI can create the next Tom Cruise and the next Mission Impossible movie, such that Tom Cruise doesn't have to be a part of it at all, people will value in a capitalist market the real experience, seeing a live human, you know, because it matters more. Somehow that will matter more because in a post-care, I mean, we see it with information, even in influencers. It's like as soon as information or guacamole, actually, I guess is the more relevant one, as soon as it becomes everywhere, people stop valuing it, right? And so as if AGI becomes so ubiquitous, then it's not going to be valued in a traditional sense of how we value things. And so the things we value will be by nature rare, which will be humanity and the nature of feelings and all that kind of stuff. But it also, and this ties back to your theme song, you know, it means that people can create art, because I feel like art is more of a business now, but create art for the sake of art, right? Because it's a creative act for the sake of creativity. It doesn't matter if anyone reads it or not, because, you know, AI is creating all the content that people can consume and want to pay for. So now you can just do it for yourself. And I think it's really interesting. But I also think going a step further, for so much of humanity, we've existed to do, right? And we're on the cusp of probably being able just to be. And I'm not comfortable with how just to be, you know? I think that's going to be a huge, huge shift and challenge. And it's going to be ugly for a while because a lot of people are going to be very uncomfortable with it.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, certainly after selling my company, I found myself in exactly that quandary of I could just be, but that doesn't feel right, right? So yeah. I don't know how rapidly that particular societal change will run through, you know, our psyches. I hope we handle it well. I mean, certainly there's a percentage of the population that's retired or that, I think it's 30%, Ron. I read this, that 30% of people don't actually work for a living. So, and that's
really
that, of adults. So some of the structure is there in society to enable us to move into that mode. But yeah, it's going to be very uncomfortable for a lot of people for a while.
Yeah. On that note too, and we kind of touched on this off the top, you're talking about the newsletter and trying to get to 100,000 subscribers and all that kind of stuff. Have you ever thought about why? I mean, one of the things that is baked into the entrepreneurial mind is growth almost at all costs, right? Mm-hmm. But I've really come around to the place of, I would rather have a lifestyle business that produces consistent cash flow than try and kill myself and grow a Facebook, right? I wouldn't want to be Mark Zuckerberg, even if I could be, notwithstanding, you know, the fact that like he's an enemy of everybody. But even when things were going great and it was young and it was exciting and it was growing like crazy and it must have been a fucking cool ride at that time, I realized like, oh man, I don't want that pressure. Like that is too much. And so it's like, why the focus on growth? And have you thought about that?
Oh, no, I've definitely thought about it. And, you know, I know that if I put resources and my full energy into another venture, it might take me three tries, but I'll create another audiobooks.com. I'll create something that could make me, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And that truly is like, so what, to what end? I did discover after selling my company that the money didn't change my life, right? It gave me higher quality problems, right? So the growth now is, I have this sense, and I can't turn it off. Like, you know, like you're an entrepreneur, I can't turn off this sense of, well, if I get to 100,000, then I can monetize it. I can hire a staff. I can have a podcast. I'll get ads on the podcast. I can hire people that make my life easy, and I can just focus on what I like, which is writing. So it doesn't feel like work. And according to Scott Galloway, who's one of my favorite podcasters, that when you get to that level of notoriety, people just start calling you up and saying, hey, will you come talk to our corporate sales conference? We'll give you $400,000 for, you know, an hour of work. So, and I really like public speaking. So it feels like there's this cascade of things. And as long as I'm not too focused on this must happen, and I just focus on I like to write. So I'm going to write. And then my entrepreneurial brain puts a little scaffolding around it that might turn it into a business someday. And if it doesn't, what am I going to lose? I'm not going to lose anything, because I'll tell you something really interesting about the writing that I didn't realize when I started, is the writing, the most valuable, the person who finds this writing the most valuable is myself. For a few reasons. One is it gets my thoughts out, and I didn't realize my biggest financial mistake I ever made was this $5 million stock investment in Atai. Which is a psychedelic stock that Ronan knows well. But the reason it was such a bad investment, I didn't know, I didn't trigger on it until I wrote an article about it. And it came out that the money that we invest is money that we don't think we're going to lose, right? Whereas the money we spend, we know we're going to lose it. So we don't, there's a limit to just how bad our spending decisions can be, but our investing decisions can be a whole different magnitude of bad. And I realized that from my writing. And now when I write things down, I remember them a lot better. So the next time I'm freaking out at a kid's hockey game, I remember I'm just watching a movie. Just watch a movie, get your heart rate down, because I wrote about that. And I find that happens all the time now as I'm go through a particularly bad business situation or a relationship question. And it's like, well, God, I've written about this. What did I say? I'm not a complete idiot. I must have said something useful. So it, so if nothing else happens, I have this trove of what amounted to wisdom at the time that I wrote down. My kids can read it. I'll read it again. 20 years from now. So I'm enjoying the hell out of this.
That's fantastic. I love to hear that. And I'm actually, my kind of hope for the podcast as well is similar lines, which is I like public speaking as well. And so to get up and paid to spout my shit off and share that to the world and get paid for it sounds like a dream come true. But it's interesting. I had a migraine this morning because whenever I do high intensity interval training on my Peloton, I seem to get a migraine. So maybe there's a lesson in that for someone out there. As I was lying there, I was having this thought about, in preparation actually for this conversation, about it seems like it's innate in humanity to want to leave your mark on this world, right? Mm-hmm. And I had this idea of like, well, maybe we're not leaving our mark on this world. Maybe we're leaving a scar on this world. Like I was thinking about the pyramids, right? Like mm-hmm. to us, they're beautiful images, but like someone had to go and, build a fucking pyramid that stands in the sky and now everybody has to see it. Right. And it was like a pharaoh who's like, oh, look at the glory of me. Right. And I think some of that is baked into some of this. And so I was wondering like, is it possible, that getting from a post ego perspective, it's just like, just come and share, right? Like you don't need to leave your mark. Just come and experience and tell stories, right? Sit around the fire and tell the stories like humanity did thousands of years ago. Maybe somewhere in just the desire to share as opposed to necessarily to have an audience is what they're, it's the creative act by definition. I started reading the Rick Rubin book, but a little bit hard to get. I don't know. Have you read The Creative Act by Rick Rubin?
I haven't actually. No.
It's fairly esoteric, but it's like there's something in there. I think
you just talked me out of it. So
then no need.
Like I was saying about finding things easy, is I like reading books that I find easy to read. I've tried the hard stuff. For me, it was like I read The Tale of Two Cities, and I stopped a third of the way through, skipped to the last chapter, read that so that I could say I read A Tale of Two Cities. No, read stuff that's easy. There's no shortage of easily ingested material out there. I think, with regard to leaving a legacy, I don't think of it that way. I find myself cringing a little bit when I see people who say want to live forever, want to freeze their brains. I'm not ruling out that I do that, by the way, just out of curiosity. But I really like what you said there. It's like, how about having an impact right now, right? Just sit around the campfire, share your stories. People could share more. Everybody could share more. I see people who don't want to talk about their problems. It's like, dude, if you just let it out, right? People will help you, right? But not everybody has realized that yet. So we need to lead the way, Ronan, by sharing on podcasts.
There we go. Exactly. I have my next question was, what's the difference between being wealthy and being rich? I know we've kind of touched on the subject already, but I thought your insights on it were pretty profound. And, I know you were talking about like money doesn't, it creates, what did you say exactly about like better problems?
Another article that I've written is that everybody should pretend to be wealthy instead of pretending to be rich. Cause I wrote something a long time ago. It's like rich is about spending money, right? It's about having a big house, about having a fancy car, about the Rolex and a nice suit. And none of those are about who you are, right? But wealth brings with it a level of how to put it, not caring, right?
Yeah.
Rich people care what you think about them. That's why they have all of these flashy things. Wealthy people don't give a fuck. They're like, I'm me, right? I've discovered what makes me tick. I'm not striving to make more money or striving for anything, frankly. So, because I'm wealthy, right? And so that's what I mean by pretend to be wealthy, is adopt that mindset of I'm just me, take it or leave it. I think, I mean, not all wealthy people are like that, but I think quite a few of them are.
And you experienced that more recently on your experience on the Ritz-Carlton yacht collection. Can you talk about that?
I went on this very expensive boat, the Evrima Ritz-Carlton yacht. And I thought I was going to be surrounded with a bunch of old people who would be overweight, like every other cruise ship I've ever been on, and kind of full of themselves. And what I found was, no, it's like it was actually somewhat younger, people in their 40s who had just made a lot of money early, and they weren't trying to show off to anybody. They just wanted to be on a boat. It was one of the most relaxed atmospheres I'd ever seen. It shocked the hell out of me, actually. I don't know. I mean, do wealthy people frequent the Ritz-Carlton? Maybe rich people are at the Four Seasons. I actually don't know. I haven't had enough experience with this to know what's going on. All I know is that I was confused. I was on this boat right. And presumably people who are wealthy also tend to be healthier. They have personal yep. trainers. They can afford high quality food. I don't know. It was overall just a fantastic experience. I highly recommend it, Ronan.
I suggested it to Steph, and she's like, yes. I'm like, well, we're not quite there at spending, what was it, like $3,000 a night for the room or however it is. It's expensive. But I did appreciate the the kind of insight of like, spend your money on things that matter, right? Like, it was a great experience. So choose how you spend your money wisely, I guess, was the primary insight out of it.
Yeah, exactly. There are expensive things you can do that are completely worth it. Right. And there's a lot of things you can do that are complete waste of time. So just don't do them again. Right. It's worth experimenting.
That's for sure. If great stories don't start with salad or end with cats, what do they start and end with?
Okay. You're quoting from all my articles.
Cause like there's so much good wisdom in all of these that like, I just tried to like find ways to bring them out.
So great stories always start with people. And, you know, so I used to think that, as most young people, it's about the destination, right? I want to make this much money. I want to work for this company. I want to live in this house. And then you realize, I think everybody realizes over time, that it's about the journey, not the destination, right? That you have to enjoy all the steps along the way. And, you know, we've talked about it. Find things that are easy to do that you enjoy. But my latest revelation is it's not about the destination or the journey. It's about the people in the car with you. So All great stories start with a group of friends or a group of colleagues or a group of people who are going, it's like The Hangover, right? That story started with those four guys. It's not the fact that they're in Las Vegas. They would have had a wild and crazy time no matter where they were. It's about the people that you're with. All great stories start and end with the people that you're with.
Yeah. And I have one last question from all of your posts. And it's germane because the first podcast, a good long podcast that we recorded last week with a woman named Florence Schaefer, who has started a company called Becoming, which is a concierge wellness and mental health service. And she invited me to attend their beta retreat in Portugal in January. So I went and it was a great experience. Oh, and, okay. 2 days before, I guess the episode will be out by the time this one comes out, so I'm not giving anything away, but in the week leading up to this first execution of their retreat, her boyfriend kicked her out of their house because I guess he's of some descent, and so there's conflict between the fact that she was not of the same ethnic origins as he. And then 2 days before we were about to go, she found out she had cancer. And so she went, she came to the retreat. She had to leave early to start some of the testing and all that kind of stuff. And she gets home and she finds out she has stage 4 breast cancer. And
oh my God.
Would be just dumbfounded about how chipper and cheerful she is, and how it's been such a revelation for her. And in so many ways, it lines up with the story you talk about how a heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to you. And I mean, feel free to share that story and the insights. But the question I have is, do you know a lot of people? I mean, you and Florence share this experience, different disease or you know, mental or different health issue, but you share the belief that it's there's something wonderful, there's a kernel of wisdom in it that's super meaningful and powerful. But you're also entrepreneurs, you know, and have had a remarkable degree of success. And I don't know how many people share that perspective, that such a scary health incident would be reflected on so positively. But I don't know if you've had that experience from other people or heard similar stories. What's been the feedback there?
People do get a little bit caught up in the moment of a health scare. And yeah. I've seen a friend of mine passed away from cancer a year ago. He himself hid it from people. His family, people around him, people reacted very badly to it. It doesn't feel like there's been any learning or growth from the experience. And maybe it's been part because it did actually kill him.
Right.
In my experience, the things that have happened to me that are the worst, bipolar disorder, a heart attack, they forced me to look at my life and change my life and right. in ways that became dramatically better. So it's a case of, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But it's fascinating that you're saying Florence has gotten all this bad news, but is chipper and has a smile on her face. That's a whole different level of emotional well-being that I have to constantly remind myself when something bad is happening that it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Don't let the anxiety overtake you. So kudos to her for being yeah. there now. I remember when Roland Griffiths, you know, pioneer in psychedelics, found out he had brain cancer. He was very stoic and wise and like, I admire the hell out of how he handled the last year of his life. I hope that when something like that happens to me, that I have the same grace, in that age.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I look at in awe at Florence and her attitude, cause I think I'd be freaking the fuck out, anxious all the time, like in a crappy mood. And she's just like, it just revealed to me what actually matters, and that, you know, when the path I was on was the wrong path, and now I'm on a different path. And I'm like, man, I respect the hell out of that. Like it's so inspiring and powerful. And, you know, you go back on your writing every once in a while and to try and seek the nugget, and I'll probably have to go back and listen to that over and over to remember that every time I get freaked out, cause I think something's wrong with my body, that I just have to maintain a positive attitude towards it.
Yep. And that'll be the best way to make your body healthy in the future. And if it doesn't work out, hey, it's been great. So, you know, I don't know. That's a function for me anyway. I know I'm not going to freak out when I find out I'm dying or plane is going down or something, because I died already on 800 micrograms of LSD. That's a whole different story. But I saw what happens after death. It's not that bad. It's all good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a part of me, I mean, because I kind of came up in the DMT experience, but it really kind of goes back to like, there's something bigger, broader, unseen that's going on, and that we're just popping out in this physical reality for a while, then we go back to something else. What that is, I don't know. And I think that unknown is what scares the shit out of people. But, you know, intuitively, it makes a lot more sense, because, and we won't go down this rabbit hole, but every time I come back to like, what does the universe exist in the first place? It always comes back the only logical conclusion that there has to be a purpose or a reason or something driving behind it. Otherwise, there's no reason for existence at all. And so I try to hold on to
I have my answer. What's your answer, Ronan, on that one? Like, why are we here?
Why does the universe? Yeah. I think it's just, I'm not sure I fully subscribe to the view that, you know, we're just the universe experiencing itself. But that, you know, we all just get a chance to experience things. Like we're all learning. Like it's just like the more experience, the more that we experience, the more that we learn, the more that we do, the more that we be, the more information there is. Like, there's just more of existence as a result of it. So it's kind of close to the idea of it's just the universe experiencing itself. But I think it's just like experience accumulation is the purpose of it all. What about you?
I feel like you may have said the same thing two different ways. Because I agree with both of them. And, you know, in the throes of a full-blown 5-MeO-DMT experience, it becomes very obvious to me that I am just a mechanism for the universe to experience itself, right? So it's my job to get out there and experience as many things as possible, to create more experiences so that it gets to experience itself, right? Now, I don't know what it is, right? The universe, very amorphous kind of concept. I say I saw it on 800 micrograms of LSD. I suggest if anybody else wants to see God or what the center of creation, God's a loaded word. Yes, LSD will take you there. So
yeah, so will five. Holy shit.
Anyway, no, that's it. It's all, I completely agree with you. It's all about experience, right? It's just about experience. So make sure you have lots of cool experiences, right? Because that's the only purpose there is. And the best experiences with other people. That's it. So keep meeting interesting people.
That was the insight yesterday. I actually had walking around with Jason, and I was thinking about you and I was thinking about Jason at the same time, which is like one heuristic. And I wrote it down. I wrote the intro to this conversation before we even had the conversation, but one heuristic I'm going to have going forward is spend time you enjoy spending time with. And you and Jason are two people that I just enjoy every interaction. It's always easy and peaceful and fun and meaningful. And so I take that, I say that as in gratitude for you joining here, but just for the relationship we've managed to have over the last 5 years. Thank you. Thank you for being who you are and what you're doing. And
yes, I haven't written about it yet, but my personal philosophy has evolved now to be like my mission statement. My personal mission statement is more better relationships, right? And it's like, that's not more relationships and it's not better relationships. More better means something different to me, right? So it's like, I want to deepen the relationships I have, and I want to continue meeting new people because that's valuable as well. More better. I will write about it one of these days.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to it. What's on tap for the rest of this year for you? Just more writing or anything else in
the more vision? Writing. I'm actually divesting myself of a bunch of businesses that have kind of accumulated over the last few years, because I really want to focus on the writing. I'll keep my bar because I love having a bar. I'm experimenting with the notion of having a monthly meetup, maybe even more frequently with people who want to say hello, because I get a lot of that, especially after the viral video. So we'll see, because a lot of famous podcasters or writers, and I'm thinking of Tim Ferriss and Scott Galloway here that I follow, are actually introverts, and they don't want to put themselves out there. Whereas for me, that's easy. I like being in a bar and having a drink and talking to people. So maybe I can make something out of that that's a little differentiating that I enjoy as well. So.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to hopefully getting an invitation to one of those meetups.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, we'll get you out there, and we can joint host one of these. That'll be a lot of good. Given that eventually we're going to have been on each other's podcasts.
Yep.
It'll be a great opportunity. Yeah.
Look forward to it. That was Sanjay Singhal. He's an awesome
dude. Yeah. Really cool conversation. I could see why you guys are friends. You know, it's interesting, as your podcast producer, I have seen the documentary that you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened with the distribution, but one of the things that really stood out to me from the beginning was him talking about how he recreationally uses 5-MeO-DMT like once a month.
Yep.
And I saw your reaction in the documentary, which was basically kind of like, I don't really remember much from it. I was experienced a death experience. I got the feeling that you probably didn't ever want to do it again. Is that true?
Yes, but I'm a sucker for punishment, right? And it's one of the things I'm trying to learn, but like, I don't take no for an answer. So if something's fucking hard, I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway. Right. And so even though that first experience was terrible, actually we did three, you know, sessions in that one day. And the first one I'm like, that was fucking terrible. And it was a small dose. And then I'm like, good sense would have said, stop there. And I'm like, but we're doing a documentary, so let's do a second dose. So I did a second dose, and I came out of the second dose, and I'm like, I feel hungover. That was terrible. And I'm like, all right, but we're here, so I'm going to do the third dose. And I did the third dose, and I actually had a breakthrough moment on the third dose, but it was fucking hard to get there. And interestingly, I didn't have a migraine for about 2 years after that. But I still did 5-MeO. You know, one time Irvin Welsh, I should try and get Irvin Welsh, actually. I'm going to reach out to Irvin because he and I did 5-MeO, kind of following up on that together. And they're just honestly just not pleasant experiences. Some insights, but like Dan, who was in the documentary, Dan Poneman, he talked about his ayahuasca experience with me as being like psychological terror. And then it turned into bliss. And that's how I'd kind of describe 5-MeO for me.
Yeah. One of the reasons that kind of stood out to me is maybe there's a crossover between really adventurous entrepreneurs and people who are kind of advanced psychonauts who are a little fearless. I have done LSD, but 200 micrograms, and that was enough. This talk of 800 is like terrifying to me. I've combined a little bit of MDMA and psilocybin, and that's kind of like as deep as I want to go. I was invited to do ayahuasca once, and the idea of being that nauseous and it being kind of like jarring my life, I don't know. I have this feeling of like, I'm okay to leave some growth and wisdom on the table. And maybe that's just my ego wanting to hold on to something, some semblance of sanity. But yeah, there's just something about, I almost think people's brains are wired a little bit differently if they can go that deep down the psychonaut rabbit hole and come back and be a normal person.
You know, that may be the case. I think the real crux of it, and maybe it's just the entrepreneurial mindset. You know, for me, it wasn't even the entrepreneurial mindset. It was just, I was so tired of people telling me no. You know, I think it was a function of how I grew up that I'm just like, I'm never going to let anybody tell me no. I'm going to experience everything. Right. And so I think that's what's kind of motivated me. It's like, it's a little bit of that adolescent, fuck you, I'll do what I want. But it's a little bit also of that, like, shit, we're only here so long. You know, I'm already halfway through this life according to most age metrics. It's like, let's do it. Like Tom Robbins, give me life, all of life, the miserable as well as the superb. And now I've been fortunate. I haven't had to deal with too much of the miserable. And as alluded to in that conversation, when it comes to some of the scarier miserable stuff, I don't know how I'm going to handle it. And I may come to regret ever repeating that quote. But that's kind of the principle I live by, which is like, let's do it. Like, let's just do it.
I feel that, you know, I want to kind of experience all life has to offer while we're here, short, limited time. Another thing that stuck out to me, I thought was really funny, is when you mentioned Dave Asprey.
Yeah.
Because I'm here in Austin, Texas, and I produce content for entrepreneurs. So we kind of run in similar circles. I probably bumped into Dave 5 times in the last 6 months, just at parties and events. And, you know, he's talking about how he's going to live to 150 or 200 and all of this stuff. And the thing that really troubles me is that it seems like people don't care about like what is true. People are more interested in like what is compelling. And you guys kind of touched on that, this idea of like, a little bit of audience capture. You start getting popular and you start getting traction talking about something. And then it's almost like your audience owns you and you just get further and further down that rabbit hole until, the truth doesn't really matter anymore. And that's one of the things I've always liked about your show.
Until you're shining sunlight on your butthole. That's like the latest. Like, I remember seeing a picture of Dave, like, spread eagle, like censored, but like latest thing is like getting vitamin D on your butt. And I'm like, okay, this is when it's, you know, you've jumped the shark.
Well, it's kind of like in the fitness space. There's a lot of value in like fundamentals, like movement, running, throwing, jogging, big compound lifts. And then it's always going to be more interesting on Instagram when someone is doing something novel and weird looking, because that gets millions of views as opposed to like something that just like works and won't injure you.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and listen, I think there's a time and place for all of that. And like, life is about experimentation, do interesting stuff, but recognize, you know, when you're deviating from the foundations, that you're deviating from the foundations. And there's a cost that come with it. I actually saw, even though I lament social media, one of the things I saw recently, one person I'm a fan of is Ryan Holiday. And he had an Instagram post talking about how Frank Ocean, you know, made the decision to work less and spend more time with his kids. And Frank's view was, it's easy. Like, I guess someone asked him, like, how do you do that? And he's like, it's easy. I just accepted the trade-off of that. I work less and I make less. It's okay. You know, it's, we live in a world where I think people think they can have it all. And if we get back to the place that like every decision has consequences and that's perfectly okay, we'd be all a lot better off.
Yeah, as a big fan of hip hop, I work and Ryan Holiday. I think I heard him say something like that. And I think Frank was talking to another musician and they were like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. Like, he's basically just saying, yeah, you just have to leave money on the table. And that's really tough. And kind of perfectly segues into this other thing I wanted to mention is you and Sanjay talked a little bit about wealth. And you said something about like not wanting to be Zuckerberg and all the stress that comes along with that.
Yeah.
And it made me think about kind of like the Zuckerberg versus like Tom from MySpace dichotomy.
Right.
Like Tom had his exit. And now he just like travels the world, and I probably wouldn't even recognize him if he walked past me on the street.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the things I love about these kind of podcasts is I can gain the wisdom of Sanjay without having to have had the big exit or created that kind of wealth. Just this idea of like what you were talking about of like a lifestyle business that gives you a good life. And creating balance.
Yep. I that's one of the things that I've learned, I think, probably the hard way. It's like, you listen to the conversation after we stopped recording about different projects on the go. It's like, I don't want any of them to scale. Or listen, I am happy for them to scale. I'm happy for them to get massive. I just don't want to be running them. Like, it's just, I'd rather spend time with my kids. I'd rather walk them to school. I'd rather, you know, becoming an entrepreneur kind of becomes its own spirituality, especially at scale, because it's always just hovering around your head, right? You never stop thinking about it. And I've just come to realize that I'd rather spend time thinking about my kids or, you know, what feels good or something deep and philosophical that reveals something than, you know, whether our operations are highly efficient or if I have to fire somebody or anything along those lines. It's just, I just got to that point. And it took the shit kicking of the boom and bust of Field Trip to, I think, come to that realization.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the word I was looking for earlier is like vicarious. I'm getting those insights vicariously through these kind of conversations instead of having to burn the candle at both ends.
Do they land though? Like that was one of the questions, which is like, I don't know. I do believe in the conscious evolution of consciousness. And I think people are getting smarter, younger, that they don't necessarily have to go through the trials and tribulations that we or previous generations have had to go through. But are you actually able to like receive them, you know, living vicariously? Or like, do you still feel like you probably are going to have to go through that to some degree, maybe not as intensely as me or Sanjay have experienced at some point in your life?
I think yes and no, in the sense that what like a Scott Galloway would talk about is that your 20s and 30s and 40s are about grinding and creating security and wealth so that you can have a good long life. So I guess there's a balance to be struck there, but it's just really nice to have very successful friends who remind me constantly that this gold at the end of the rainbow you're chasing after is not going to like solve all your problems. Cause I've seen it very close, you know, having worked at capitalism.com for 3 years, met a lot of very unhappy millionaires and decamillionaires and centimillionaires. So there's a part of me that goes, yeah, your 30s is about finding what you're good at and offering value to people and creating a lot of security for yourself, for your future. This is the chapter of life in which sometimes you will be out of balance. But yeah, it's very valuable to know that, like, yeah, that whatever, fancy trip, Lamborghini, big number in your bank account isn't going to change the internal experience of, like, what it is like.
To move through the world. That was the biggest lesson of mine, without doubt. You know, I'm still grateful for it because it's opened a lot of doors. And I think that's probably the bigger thing for me is not the money, which of course is nice, but like now, especially as a person who didn't have a great sense of self-confidence as a kid, like being able to walk into a room and feel like I belong, you know, it didn't give me that confidence, but it kind of gave the catalyst to maybe start believing that. Like, okay, I'm not an imposter here. I've done what other people who, you know, I thought were above or more successful than me have done. Now I can walk in. And what I found a lot of the time is like, I walk into those rooms. I was part of, Summit, the Jim Tofer Summit. I remember going to like all these entrepreneurial events and all these people talked about is their fucking business. And I'm like,
don't
let your identity, like don't let your business become your identity. Life is much more interesting than that, at least for me.
Speaking of identity and building businesses, you mentioned Field Trip, and also made a note here that Sanjay talked about investing in Atai Life Sciences.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. I think he said like $5 million because Peter Thiel was also a big investor. Yeah. And he was talking about heuristics of like one heuristic is follow the great investors. They're putting their money. Maybe I should put my money in there too.
Yep.
I told you, I also on a much smaller scale invested into Compass Pathways and Atai Life Sciences and Field Trip Health.
Yeah.
And I learned not to invest in things that just feel good, like emotionally, because I'm like, yeah, I support this sector. Like I'll put my money where my mouth is. So I'm done picking stocks, personally. But yeah, I wanted to ask you about kind of almost a contradiction where you're saying almost like you guys are not as bullish on, let's say, the psychedelic renaissance, maybe as you used to be. But on the other hand, I think all three of us would say that we've had pretty transformational, life-changing experiences that have made us like better people.
Yep.
So how do you square those two things of kind of easing off the gas pedal of like, this is going to change society and it's going to make everything better, like the utopian vision, versus being like, this is actually still very helpful for a lot of people in the right context or circumstances?
Well, I think that's the exact square, right? Like it's, you know, it's not a revolution, it's an incremental change. And now incremental change over time becomes a large and can become a revolution, but I thought it'd be a lot faster, you know? And, you know, I think the big lesson is like psychedelic retreats in particular, like summer camp, right? Like you go and you have a novel experience in a place and time. And this is exactly what comes out in the documentary. And the connections you form feel so much more intense. And they just, in my experiences, don't last, you know. Some of them do, but not with the same degree of intensity. And you can still get hurt, right? All of a sudden, like you think you have a bond with these people, and they can never hurt you. And then they disappear and you've been hurt. And so that's kind of like the insights of like all of the things that sometimes suck about life, like getting hurt. I think deep down, like we'd all come to like love each other and everything would be amazing and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, we're not there. And psychedelics can't do that. But in the moment you feel like psychedelics can. So it's just more incremental. And that incremental change, I think long-term is going to have a massive impact. It's just going to be a lot slower than maybe I thought.
Yeah. That makes sense. So well, I hope these things will be a part of our future, even though it's, maybe one of the lessons is that nothing is a silver bullet or a panacea.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's no such thing as silver bullets, but I do believe in silver linings, right? So, and that was the thing. I think, you know, Sanjay and me early days, I was like, this is a panacea. Like, this is going to be huge. And it will be, but just in a, you know, I guess in a very psychedelic way, it's just going to be a little bit gentler than like not as you start to see that it's a little bit more mature than maybe the adolescent views that we had on it.
Well, I loved you guys' conversation. I hope our audience enjoys it half as much as I did. He's just a really, really interesting guy. We have to have Sanjay back. Maybe check in with him on 6 months or something.
I'm happy to have Sanjay back anytime. He's always got good stories to share, that's for sure.